The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 35. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I've got a tremendous amount of respect for. He's someone that's really shaped my thinking, along with guys like Doug Casey and Rick Rule. His name is Marin Katusa. Marin, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
It's my pleasure.
Okay, so I want to start off with kind of explaining the typical viewer I have. They're really concerned about inflation. They're concerned about deflation. They're concerned about the central banks, the quantitative easing, and all the money printing. I know we're going to get into specifics, but just from a macro view, a 30,000-foot level, what would your advice be to kind of the average Joe?
The location you're in really depends on the situation you'll be. So let's just take the let's focus on the United States of America. Now, we've got subscribers in over 100 countries, but let's just focus on the U.S. Right now, whether you're apolitical, left-leaning, or right-leaning, it doesn't matter, because the reality is this. Whether you're in Russia, anywhere in South America, if you look at Asia right now, you look at the currencies, so much of the emerging market debt is actually priced in U.S. dollars, number one. Number two, U.S. is still the primary market, the number one consumer in the world. So as much as we have to worry about what the U.S. Fed is doing, it still is the strongest currency. And whether you're in Russia, Turkey, Argentina, Bolivia, it doesn't matter where you go. It's U.S. dollar still the king dollar. So if you're in the U.S., the dollar is going to do well compared to the other currencies. Gold is going to be a great place to hedge yourself as an insurance to other currencies. But you look at what's going on in the rest of the world. If your debt is priced in U.S. dollars, but your revenue is in that local currency, that's where the big pressure and problems are going to be. So just be careful where you position yourselves. And you look at the stock market, a lot of people don't understand that. We've never been in a place historically where such passive management is over 50% of the capital in the market. And it's in the situation where what happens when that unwinds, right? We've never seen it's great when the passive funds are starting to buy, but what happens when they start selling? Well, you've seen essentially what happened on the Tesla shorts. That was essentially Renaissance and a couple of other large funds, passive management go into play the shorts. So this is a wild, wild west we're getting into, where fundamentals may not matter to the point where fundamentally they should, but eventually they will. So be careful.
Marin, I've heard you mention in a few recent interviews that negative interest rates are a financially transmitted disease. Those are your words. Can you explain that a little bit further?
You know, the knock-on effects of a slowing economy in China because of the coronavirus, the knock-on effects of Brexit, you know, with the UK. There's so many different factors that play into hand here that are going to take many months to play out. And these are all negative for growth. And that's the big issue, is growth. Now, the US, you know, like Brent talks about, is sucking, his whole thesis is it's sucking capital from the world. And you're having an election year, and you know that Trump is going to do everything he can. When historically do you have a president daily talking about the stock market? Like that's never happened before.
Exactly.
And more importantly, a president whose companies have gone bankrupt four times, like his companies have declared bankruptcy four times. So right. We're in this new twilight zone period. I call it quantum economics, because when you come from the Keynes area of, you know, stimulus, they never factored in negative interest rates would be such a thing. You look what's going on in the Japanese economy. You look at what's going on with the retirement. The boomers are starting to retire, but they're not in a position to retire. And you look at the debt levels. This is probably the scariest fiscal time in the history of, you know, modern finance. And this negative interest rates, I call them FTDs, financially transmitted diseases. 2.5 years ago, I stood up and said, this is where we're going for the next 5 years. And gold and the US dollar will go up together. And my partner, Doug Casey, and Rick Rose, also a partner, great, good friends of mine. I started out as them being my mentors. They were like, but Marin, this is metaphysically impossible. If the dollar goes up, the US, the gold has to go down because it's priced in dollars. I said, that's the difference. This is where we are in a different place. And it really comes down to negative interest rates, what's going on. Just yesterday, for example, Louis Vuitton, the world's largest high-end dealer. People will know him from their handbags. And, you know, they just bought out Tiffany's, a very prominent American luxury jewelry brand. And Arnaud, who's the richest man in France, they asked him, well, how are you going to finance this? He said, no problem. I'll go to the bond market and it'll cost me somewhere between 0 and 1% money. The market laughed. They thought he was crazy. Well, 1/3 of that debt was in negative interest rates. Now think about this.
Wow.
The market, the ECB, the European Commission, is actually paying this guy to go and buy an American retailer. Now, why? Well, because the key there for LVMH, they're very smart. They realize that this luxury brand is bringing in US dollars and the company needs US dollars to hedge its other currencies that will be going down, and we see that in real time. So negative interest rates are deflationary. And there's this huge misunderstanding in the market here that I really want to focus on. Essentially, let's bring it down to as simple of a way we can look at it. When there's more dollars out there, that's inflationary because there's more dollars chasing the same fixed number of goods. But negative interest rates, you would think that they would be throwing out the dollars, but the velocity of capital actually slows down and there's fewer dollars to go after those fixed goods. Therefore, that is deflationary.
You mentioned the coronavirus there briefly, and I wanted to get your take on that and how that may affect the supply chains in China as an example, and of course, the price of gold on a moving forward basis.
One of my subscribers is the head of Canada's infectious diseases and for the country. And I asked him to do a write-up. I'm not an expert in that area, so I go around and figure out who is. So I went to the top guy of our country and he wrote a phenomenal piece. He's updated it, and I send it out to my subscribers with my comments and questions to him. And essentially the answer to that is nobody quite yet knows the extent of this. The other thing is do you really ask yourself, do you trust the Chinese numbers? You know, that's another question you have to ask yourself. So what we've been focusing on is outside of China's numbers. That's something to focus. But you see across the board, when companies like Apple come out and say, we're not going to hit our numbers, the knock-on effects, think of Foxconn and all their manufacturers that supply that, the supply chain. When you look at one of our colleagues, good friends, lives in China, so we get him to send us photos in areas that technically shouldn't be affected in the area. They're not in Wuhan. They're outside of the areas. There's still ghost towns there. People are not spending the type of money. More importantly, not all of the companies in China are these Tencent and these massive multi-billion dollar companies that are backed by the government. There's so much of the society is small businesses, and those small businesses aren't able to pay their clients, but legally the government says you have to at least pay some. So think about the knock-on effects of that. So people are realizing that they may or may not get paid. If they do, it's going to be less. They're going to spend less. And the knock-on effects of that within China are going to be significant. So you're going to see, you know, slower growth demand within China. So from a commodity standpoint, which I focus on, you've already seen it in the oils. They've reduced their oil consumption by 3 million barrels a day. That's the biggest ever in China's history. Then you look at what about the base metal consumption? You see it in steel, you see it in copper. To be frank, I'm surprised. And I started out as a copper guy. Like I was one of the founders of Canada's third largest producing copper company. I was the largest investor in the deal. Like, right. I love copper. I believe in copper in the long run. It's part of this like solutions for a greener world. But I'm shocked that it's still trading in that 250, 265 range. I would have expected it further down because my sources are saying there's some significant stockpiles that we see.
Those are great points. I want to make sure that I also ask you about energy, because I know that's something that you follow really closely. And I know a lot of my viewers always talk about oil and uranium. Do you have any thoughts on those?
I wrote a whole chapter in my book about oil and the history, what's going on with the Middle East and the geopolitics angle and the petrodollar. Oil is so important to the geopolitics. And when you look at what I'm calling the unwind of the petrodollar, where America used to send these US dollars and military support to a regime like, say, Saudi Arabia, and in return, they would get two things. People think it's just oil, but then the Saudis or the Kuwaitis would invest into the long-term development and demand of American goods and American infrastructure. So now we're seeing a very different thing. The world, the rest of the world, is getting less US dollars sent out to it because America's gone from about 4.5 million barrels of production a day to over 11. So we need less of other people's stuff. So there's less dollars going out, but the rest of the world got addicted to that, you know, easy flow of US dollars. So there's less US dollars floating around to service existing US dollar debt. So that's one thing. Number two, technologies are getting there. And you would not believe how much hate I have received, both in 2009, when I said the green revolution was overhyped, and a lot of my colleagues blew themselves up because it was priced to perfection. Then in 2014 and 15, when I became the second largest investor in Canada's purest green energy company, nobody cared. Nobody cared. They said, what are you talking about? Green energy didn't work. Obama's stuff is garbage. You know, the green dream is dead. And the reality here is then we were buying these assets at, you know, 25 to 30% of NAV. And our company, Altera, that I kept talking about for 3 years on the front page of the largest newspaper in the country, saying, this is how you build wealth. These things are now developed and they're trading at a 90% discount to just 5-6 years ago. But nobody cared. That $3.5 stock now is trading at $22 because it pays a yield. The beauty of the green energy world is when you build it and you sign these long-term PPAs, these power purchase agreements, you can go out 30 years and find out your revenue. In today's world where yield matters, the big passive funds, the big hedge fund managers, all of the sovereign wealth funds, they need income to pay out for the boomers retiring and their demand and needs. And that's where now there's this incredible demand for these fixed financial products that green energy is perfect for. So that, I think, is kind of played out. That's there. They're not cheap anymore. That run is done. When you mentioned uranium, I think people have to be very careful on uranium. And about 2 years ago, I started creating a lot of, negative comments, because I said the Kazakhs and Russians have a cut-to-kill strategy. And this is not a new strategy. The Rockefellers used this 125 years ago. And what's the advantage that the largest producers in the world have? So in the 70s and early 80s, America was the largest producer of uranium and the largest consumer of uranium. Then as things changed in the collapse of the Soviet Union, Western capital, American capital, Canadian capital, European capital, Chinese and Japanese capital flew into Russia and Kazakhstan to develop these vast wealths of deposits. That back then, when I was starting in 2002 and 3, when I went out there, they were called ISLs. ISLs was in situ leaching. I don't know if you've ever heard of these terms. Mm-hmm. Then as the marketing of it came out, they changed it to ISR, because the marketing guy said, hey, instead of calling it in situ leaching, in situ recovery sounds better. So that's how long I've been around in this game. I remember what it used to be called and the marketing come into it. Yeah. So, but here's the key. So when I remember going out there for the first time, you see all these like big companies like Cameco and Areva, that's now called Orano, which is the largest producer and consumer vertically integrated company in France. France at the time is about 75% nuclear. They were plowing money because uranium was at a much higher price. And this was a new area. Now, I wouldn't quite call Kazakhstan an AK-47 nation, but ask yourself, who do you think is going to win in a negotiation if you're sitting in Astana in Kazakhstan? Not you or me. Okay. Right. So I put it in that category, even though it's not quite as bad as it sounds. Anyways, all this foreign capital came in. They developed these assets on American technology. ISR was developed, invented, and proven in actually started in Wyoming and Texas back in the 60s in America. So then Kazakhstan, the first time I went there, was I think they were producing less than 1 million pounds of uranium. And within 16 years, went from £1 million to £65 million and produced about 45% of the world's primary uranium needs. That is massive growth. No other commodity in no other country has ever done that in the last 25 years that I know of. Okay, maybe there was, but in some niche weird metal that I've never seen anything like that. Now, the foreign companies like Cameco or whoever, they invested in these projects. And it used to be 60% foreigner, 40% Kazatomprom, the local company owned by the state government. And with time, the Kazakhs would sit there and say, hey, you know, we need, inflation's kicking around, our currency's devaluing, we need a little bit more of the ownership. And what is the foreigner going to do? Fight them in Kazakhstan with the Russians just north? Not going to work. So it goes 50-50. Then a few more years later, it's 40-60. Then it's going to go 30-70. Now, they're increasing the infrastructures there. The debt is paid off now on the assets. And the foreigners, they're kind of stuck here. What are they going to do? Now, there's two other advantages here. They're the largest producer. Secondly, they're producing in a currency. So the tenge in Kazakhstan, it's been devalued by about 70% in the last decade. So even though the price of uranium is down 50%, the currency that they are producing in is down lower, and they're selling for a stronger US dollar because that's what they sell uranium in. So even though uranium is, say, at $25 today versus 5 years ago at $40, the Kazakhs are in a better situation today on a revenue basis because of the net to the tenge to the US dollar.
Right.
Their assets have been developed by outside money, and these are world-class assets. So you have to pay attention to what the biggest players in the game is. And for some reason, the North Americans don't respect what's going on in the outside with Kazatomprom. They think that some junior company run by some company in Vancouver or whatever knows more about uranium because he went to whatever school in the West than the guys at Kazatomprom. I've sat with the head guys at Kazatomprom. These are smart, smart, smart guys. And I'm not just saying that they've used my info and my name in their PowerPoints. That's not the reason. I've never worked for them. I have never done consulting for them. But if you want to be a successful investor in this game, you have to respect what's going on and be aware of the game. And the Kazakhs are the elephant in the room that no one's paying attention to. I remember in 2015, I was asked to give the keynote at the World Nuclear Fuels Market. That's where, like, the utilities actually buy uranium.
Right.
And I sat there and I said, you have to focus on what's going on with Kazakh production. And all the North Americans just sat there and said, well, what are you talking about? We're going to produce our mine in, you know, in Niger and the Arlit Basin, and we're going to do it at $45 uranium. I go, that's great, but uranium's going to be at $30. So, and he goes, well, what do we do? I go, nothing. You're shit out of luck. Your project doesn't fly. And you got to deal with all the AK-47 aspects of being in Niger. There's a reason why Areva, which is, remember, used to be a former French colony, they developed a lot of those assets. They're basically leaving the country. So there's a lot of vacuum to fill in there. So the way to play uranium, in my opinion, again, it fits to my AK-47 concept, is Trump is going to come out with a Made for America plan. And it's not going to be buying Kazakh uranium. The Department of Defense is going, and I've written about this a year ago, it's going to be somewhere between, you know, £1 million to £2 million, between 5 to 7 million pounds a year, say $150 million a year for 5 years or 10 years. But it has to come from permitted, built American production for American Department of Defense. So like the American submarines, the American needs, that's going to come there. So you want to sit with the American developed, permitted resources, and you want world-class resources that can last 5, 10, 20 years. You don't want guys that are going to go, we're going to go permit it. Permitting a uranium mine is the hardest thing to permit. It's going to take you 10 years. So be careful on that aspect. The way I've personally played this, so a few years ago, I published that I thought this would happen. So I created a uranium royalty company. And what I want to do is pig off all the royalties that I believe at bargain basement prices when uranium's low. And when uranium goes up, which it will in a few years, that's how the success of Franco-Nevada and Silver Wheaton, these are the guys I know really well who built those companies. But the success of the gold royalty companies was done when gold was $500-$600 an ounce. It's not at $1,600 gold an ounce. So you want that upside leverage. The beauty of streaming is I don't take the permitting risk. I don't take the construction risk. It's just financial modeling. And I'm a mathematician, and that's where my strengths are. So that's how I'm playing. If you're going to play in uranium, stay away from, you know, going to far parts of the world that need massive infrastructure. You know, it's funny. When you talk about all these old assets, there a lot of them were actually discovered by the oil companies. In the last run in the late 70s, there's a great book called The Yellow Cartel. And the oil companies wanted to get into the uranium game. So they threw all this money at. So many of these projects are recycled projects that didn't work at $125 uranium. Well, there's no technology out like, you know, what fracking's done for oil in the uranium world that will take these deposits and make them economic at $30. You still need to build the infrastructure in the middle of nowhere. There's so much aspects, permitting. And, you know, if you thought permitting a copper or gold mine was hard, try permitting a uranium mine. That's the test of a good management. This is my whole concept to everybody. Why do I need to go to some undeveloped country that doesn't respect you or me for bringing in the capital? You're going to have to go through all these hurdles of educating them that, look, I've held yellow cake in my hand and people are like, oh my God, are you going to die of cancer? I'm like, guys, this is inert. Like the education, the science, it's not about science anymore. It's about emotion. What people feel is now reality.
Right.
When I could just go down to the US and buy things that have been built, permitted, and they're ready to produce now, and they're just waiting for a contract with the government. That's what it was. People forget that. That's what it was in the 60s and 70s. There was a massive uranium bull market in the 50s, 60s, and 70s because the American government was stockpiling this. Remember the Cold War? Both countries were basically buying it. And it was on the weekend. There were songs out there in the old country days about taking your Geiger counter with your family, looking for uranium, and then having a picnic with the family looking for uranium. We've got exactly 180 now that these things are trading so cheap. I don't need like to take that risk. That's the beauty of a bear market. That's how I'm playing it.
It sounds like there's a lot to be concerned with in the future. We've got everything from the coronavirus to negative interest rates. There could be an oil crisis, but I'm guessing that this could set up a once in a lifetime opportunity for a speculation. So do you have any insider information for the viewers that might help them take advantage of this uncertain future?
There's a couple of ways. So, you know, do you want to fund a geologist with a dream and an idea? I call it a box of crayons. My wife's a geologist. We met out in the industry and I tease her all the time about it. But the reality is that is a very rare, rare game of a massive world-class discovery. That, if you're part of it, you're looking north of 10, 20, 30 bagger. But I think there's low-hanging fruit. When everything's so beaten down, I don't need to take the risk of relying on a geologist coming up with a world-class discovery, that there is that area of the market, and I do play some of that, but that's not the money you want. That's speculation. That's not investing. Right now, you could be investing in uranium by completely de-risking yourself, and there's so many ways to play it. You can go and play by actual, buy companies that have physical holdings of U308 or UF6 that's required for the enrichment. There's companies that are trading at about 0.3 NAV that are built, permitted, like never mind the time lag of developing and drilling out a deposit and then permitting it. These things are trading at half the cost that they've already spent in building their mills that produce yellow cake. That's a pretty good way to play it if you've got the time frame. That's what I'm doing. Then you can play it through the royalties. And we've seen in the gold market over the last 8 years, the best way to play the gold market wasn't the producers or the discoveries. It was actually the royalty guys because it's de-risked. And as more money is managed by fewer people, and let's call it passive management, they want to be able to play something that they understand. And the royalty game is easy to understand. And they trade at, you know, some of these gold companies are trading 2.5 times NAV, net asset value. In the uranium world, you can buy something trading less than NAV. So those are the ways to play it in the market. And people have a fathom, like, I'm not one of these guys trying to sell you something or whatever. Go look at the markets. I remember there was a deal in 2011. I was up at site and it was a $25 stock. Okay, $25 stock. all the bankers, the big bankers, the big fund managers, everybody was all over the stock. Three of the biggest companies in the mining world were trying to play, buy 19% of the company, put up $800 million to develop these assets. And in 2015, just 4.5 years later, the stock went from $25 to 40 cents a share. Talk about cyclicality. What really changed other than perception? Did the government nationalize the deposit? No, because it wasn't in an AK-47 state. It was in the United States of America, so there is rule of law. There was the majors didn't want to deal with the NGO pushback of investing in such a big project, so they bailed on it. But the asset didn't change. So when I brought in and became the largest shareholder of it and restructured the board and did a financing, and that's what I love about private placements. You get that warrant kicker, which I really hope people learn more about. Within a year, that became 18 times your money, liquid, hot. And that's, you have to play cyclicality. And for all your viewers, when you go to a party and everybody's talking about gold and your wife's best friend go, hey, you know, I want to put some money into the gold market.
Right.
That's the time to sell your gold. Okay. That you don't make serious wealth when you're at a cocktail party and people know you're in gold and they're asking you all the questions. Right now, everyone in my social world knows I'm a gold guy and I've done very well in gold. They think the only reason a gold is for the things on your finger or jewelry. Mm-hmm. Nobody's asking me any questions about gold or uranium. That's a good sign for me that we've got a lot of room to run. It's on page 16 in the newspaper. When it gets on the second page, you better start getting your ducks in order to watch, okay, does it pull back to page 5 or does it go to the front page where everybody and Mad Money, Jimmy Cramer, and everybody's talking about gold? Exactly. That's when it's time to sell. We're nowhere near that yet.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So the takeaway so far is gold, dollar could be going up at the same time because they're both considered safe haven assets.
They are going up and we see it right now. We are in the early innings of this and it's going to continue for the next, I'd say at least 12, 18. I don't have a crystal ball. You just kind of go with your information as you come, but it is happening now.
Okay, well, let's hit on that. How high do you think gold can go here? I mean, we're over $1,600 an ounce today. I think that's at an all-time high for the last, at least until we got to that last top in 2011,
If I'm wrong. It depends which way you're looking at this. If you're looking at it from an inflation-adjusted view, I think it goes a lot higher. But let's look at it from the flow of capital. That's the real way to look at where these assets go. Even though we've reached $1,600 gold, guys like you who've been watching it for a lot of time, you're paying attention. The average person on the subway in America, in Canada, like our prime minister in Canada has no, I bet you if you asked him, he'd have no idea what the price of gold is. Our government in Canada owns zero gold. Your subscribers own more gold in their house than the government of Canada and the bank because they got rid of it all. So you can see that it's not on the agenda. Now, let's talk about pension funds and sovereign wealth funds. Never before have they owned so little gold as they do today. So we are still in the early, early days. And I know this sounds crazy because you know, we were just at $1,300 gold a few years ago, and we're sitting at $1,600 gold. That's really nothing. You know, when you start getting a couple of these big pension funds and sovereign wealth funds into this market, there's no reason why gold can't be $2,000 or more per ounce. Specifically, when you look at what's going on with the devaluation of the emerging market currencies or the rest of the world currencies, if you were in Turkey or Russia or Argentina, your wealth has been decreased by over 50% over the last 10 years if you held on to those local currencies. If you just bought 5% of your gold, gold's held on to that, so you've had 25% less devaluation than everyone else around you. That's a good insurance hedge that the rest of the world is starting to wake up to.
I remember going back to Eric's interview that you had, and he was saying that over the past year, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the price of gold itself and the price of the GDX and if I'm not mistaken, Rick with Sprott, went up about 30, 40%. But some way you invested in gold, it went up by like 90%. So first and foremost, am I saying that correctly? And if I am, can you kind of maybe walk us through the structure of how you created a return that was so much more substantial than gold itself or guys like Rick?
Sure. Look, Rick's a good friend. We just inducted him into the Hall of Fame. I was lucky enough to do the induction. But he's not going to argue this. My performance has been a lot better. Now, there's a few reasons why. Not because I'm smarter. You know, that's a debate for another day. But it comes down to this. I'm the largest investor in my fund. And rather than owning 40 stocks, I really honed in and focused. And since Macro Voices, we're up another 50% since then. So it's like well north of 140%.
Wow.
And my whole focus is being first to the story, structuring these products where you also get a warrant kicker. Okay. So when you do a financing, you almost get, if it works out, you get paid twice. But also, there is one asset that I really believe before everybody else. I became one of the largest shareholders in the company. And I'm a big believer in taking old data, reprocessing that data. Because when you take geology courses in university, there's this separation between the way you learn geology and the economics of geology. And because I come from a numbers background and you know, geology was more an elective courses for me to maintain my scholarship. I came from the business side always on it. And I looked at this from early on in my career and all these assets, like this one asset had 1800 drill holes and the previous owners never bothered to take analog data. So like actual, like old printouts of paper and digitalize it and put it into new software to model what this could be. I was the first guy on site and I went, holy shit, this is massive. And I went through the data. So the guy who got the company became a good friend. And I go, Cal, he paid $1 million for this asset. And I think he'll say it today. I kind of had a better grasp of it than he did at the time. And I go, I'll give you $10 million personally right now, guaranteed check from me to buy this. You get to tell all your investors you got a 10 bagger. And he went to his board and he said, well, shit, Marin's got an idea here. Let's figure out what there is. So we ended up doing a financing into his company. They said no to my idea. That now is one of the hottest, sexiest stories in the world. And they're looking at maybe somewhere between 6 to 10 million ounces of gold. The previous owners, the geologists who had this, kind of got it right because they knew there was something there, but they never took that technological advance of gapping the past with the future with new technology and software.
Right.
That was the big, big bet that I made on that. Whether you look at something like Equinox Gold, I was the first guy to publish it. And I saw that by bringing in new technology, bringing in assets, people were mocking me on it. Okay. And I just kind of did my business. But guys like Ross Speedy, serially successful guys, have put over $200 million into the deal. And it's one of the most exciting stories. And it started in my office and went from zero to over 700,000 ounces of gold produced within 3 years. That's how you go. And, you know, one thing I want to share is when I wrote up, I was the first guy to write up the potential in Newmarket because they were buying Fosterville. That became Kirkland Lake. I did that at a dollar and change. That ran to $60. My mistake there was I sold too early. And I did a whole analysis about how to sell and my mistakes. And now what I've actually told people is, look, you're sitting at like a 400% gain on this stock. You should probably reduce, and it's called the Catoosa free ride. But I'm holding on because I believe there's nothing better than this deposit in the US. And until I'm proven wrong or it gets taken out, I'm going to run with this. So there's the aspect of knowing what to buy, but then I get in and explain to people my psychology about, you know, holy crap, we're sitting at 480% gain on this. Should I sell some? And it's a struggle with an emotional going, maybe I should reduce my risk. And there's other times that, you know, the stocks don't work out that have had big runs. So it's a process. Just because I've done very well over the last 8 years doesn't mean the next 8 will be great. But every day is a battle. It's a tough market. And for me, it's an honor to be compared to guys like Rick, because 2003, when I first met him, You know, he was up on stage and I was a guy taking notes. Now, you know, sometimes we're co-investors in a deal. Sometimes we're on the other side of a deal. There's been deals that I've bought his blocks off of because I believed in it. He didn't. It worked out well for me. So everyone's got their standpoint. Everyone's got their criteria. And the advantage of what I do is because I'm the largest investor in my fund, I don't need 25 gold stocks. In our newsletter, we have 8 stocks. But the ones that I do, I have the cell phone number, the home phone number, the office phone number, the personal secretary phone number, the wife's phone number. And when I got to get a hold of the management team, I get a hold of the management team, regardless of where I am or they are in the world. That's kind of my style. I won't invest into something unless I really know the guys and I've been to the asset. I know it thoroughly. And this is a very risky game. Even after all you do, you put in all the effort going to the site visits and doing all that, creating your own models, hiring your, I got a whole team of guys that do all this stuff. That doesn't guarantee that you're going to make money. It's still a very risky game. So for me, it's been, I've de-risked it by staying away from AK-47 places. I like to stick to the rule of law. And these things are still trading at such a discount that when the bigger money figure out that, wait a second, we just got our tax raised by 25%, and that's pretty much all the economics on the mine, because that's the first thing the companies are going to do is go after the foreigners. Well, I'd rather be, you know, in Canada or the US, and not everywhere in Canada is good either. Like, as a guy born and raised in British Columbia, my parents came here as immigrants. Canada has been incredible to my family, but we've gone a little bit too left that even after you go and permit, 150 protesters can change things by just protesting things. Mm-hmm. So, and there's only one way to deal with that. Don't develop anything here. Take your money somewhere else. If your money's not being respected here, it's almost like an Ayn Rand strategy and Atlas Shrugged, go somewhere else where it is. And rather than fighting the emotion and illogic and lack of science, eventually when the jobs decrease, the average person will say enough's enough, and we're not there yet in certain parts of Canada. So as a guy who's been part of a team that built the third largest mine in Canada in copper, and I have zero projects right now in BC, that tells you where things are politically in certain parts of Canada.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that, Marin, because that's the exact same thing I used to do as an entrepreneur. And just, you know, obviously not in the gold or the mining sector, but I was in a lot of the sales and marketing advertising businesses. And it's the same thing, same way to look at people. It's the same way to leverage their skill set and just maybe something that someone isn't looking at to create the next opportunity. And it's just, I hear it, you saying that, and it just reminds me back to those days. But what really blows me away is how much of this stuff that you know. It's quite incredible. And I really appreciate your time and telling me the stories and help educating me just from a personal standpoint. I cannot wait to get back and do more reading with your with the membership side of your newsletter. So I want to be cognizant of your time. And I know I was speaking with the other Marin. It sounds like every single person in your office, their name starts with M. So
I'll give it to you better. We have our customer services, Maria. One of my former students at the university works for me. His name's Mike. My wife's name is Marina. Now you really want to twist. Okay.
All right. But I was talking to one of the other M's, and he said that if some of my viewers were interested in taking a further look or maybe signing up for your newsletter, that you guys had a really great deal for them. Do you want to outline that?
Look, for anyone who's trying it, it's a $3,500 a year newsletter. It's not cheap, but if you want quality, that's what it is. Because of your team and trying it out, we'll give you the one-time discount of $2,000. And I will put up our track record against anyone in the business, whether it's any other newsletter writer or any other fund manager. Look, we've put the numbers out there for you. Try it out. Educate yourself. It's your portfolio. Do yourself a favor.
Yeah, I strongly suggest it. I've been reading it for the last 2 weeks, and it's really helped me understand the game better. I'm still in the education phase, but I can't wait to take that next step.
You're going to have to think of what I'm doing as a commitment to your portfolio. I get into the nitty-gritty details. I show all my calculations and modeling and what I think this is going to be worth. The other thing we didn't even mention, I bring my film crew to the site. So I do it so you, as whatever job you have, you can sit on the bus, you can sit in the morning on the toilet, whatever. You can watch on an iPhone where I am underground, and I get access to things that have never been filmed before. The world's largest uranium mill, which is $3 billion. They've never had a video camera in. We needed special cameras because the radiation that was there, we had to wear special suits. Wow. You get to see what I see. When I go to these mines, you get to go see the trucks and the crushing and the blasting. You get to see the pupils of the management team and the larger shareholders, and you get to see the good, the bad, and the ugly of the story. You go to the core shacks with me. We go into the pits. It's really cool, some of the stuff we do, and the videos where every single management team that I invest in, they come into my studio and we just talk. And you get to see, this isn't no, hello, my name is Marin. It's full up. I talk to them the way I talk to them, and you get to see me hit them hard with questions. And you get to see, you know what? Marin might be wrong on this one. Or I'm like, oh, I really like what he's doing here. You get to see everything that I'm doing. And nobody else does that.
Okay. So if they want to, if my viewers want to take advantage of that opportunity, which the newsletter is typically $3,500 just because of this special deal and them being a big fan of the George Gammon YouTube channel, you're going to drop that down to $2,000 for them. I'm going to put a link that Marin will give me in the description of this video, or we'll also put a link on my website, georgegammon.com. For Marin, to find out more about you, what you do, the letter, but all of your backstory, what's the best place for people to go?
I think you should go to the website, katusaresearch.com, K-A-T-U-S-A. It's got it all there. You can Google me on YouTube. You can see all the videos. It's there. It's not hard to find.
Okay, great, Marin. I can't wait to do it again.
You bet. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.